Hello, welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning for this Monday, the 22nd of May. Very nice to have you with us. Hopefully you all had a good weekend. I don't know. It was a little rainy. It was a little sunny. It was a little warm. It was a little chilly. It was good. It was a little soupçon of weather. And that's good. We hope that you enjoyed whatever activity you were able to get in this weekend. Let me introduce our group to you. We'll get started. And love to hear from you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And we go to, John Faso is here. John, of course, is the former New York 19th Congressman, former New York Assemblyman, an attorney. A law, and what else?
Father.
Yeah, father.
Grandfather.
Most important, wait. Grandfather. Yes. Grandfather. Okay, that.
Got two of those little girls. The newest one just recently, and that's exciting.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
It's always, always good to have you on the program. Thank you very much. Jennifer Burns joins us. Did you spend the weekend on a field somewhere?
I did. Yes, I did. It was wonderful. I was explaining to everyone before this, my son went through the roller coaster of being Mr. Choke to Mr. Clutch. And so we're working on that. It was lovely.
That's good. Lovely stuff. David Sewers. Well, I apologize. Jennifer Burns is UAlbany lecturer in Africana Studies. I didn't give the proper title there. We also welcome Albany County District Attorney David Sewers. Good morning, David. How are you?
Good morning. Going from choke to clutch is like that's a description of my husbandry over the weekend.
Okay.
I will take on projects where I go from choke to clutch, and then sometimes
do you peter out?
Yeah, then my sometimes it goes in that
Again,
direction as
quick.
Well. Yeah.
It's very quick turnover.
Well, we welcome all of you to the program, and I thank you very much for being here. As always, a reminder that you can join us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Okay, let's go to the debt ceiling talks. They were off, and then they were on, and then they were off. Now they're back on. President Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy have agreed to restart the bipartisan talks. And as the clock ticks toward a June 1st deadline, lawmakers express fresh optimism about their odds of securing a deal to avoid an unprecedented default. A day after partisan acrimony disrupted talks around the debt ceiling, President Biden and House Speaker Kevin McCarthy agreed on Sunday to restart negotiations. So the hopeful sign we're talking about is really nothing concrete or as far as any progress that's being made. It's just the fact that they're actually going to sit down and talk about it, and a hopeful sign that the two parties might avoid an economic catastrophe as few as 11 days away. The two speakers spoke by phone and agreed to dispatch their chief emissaries for further staff talks on Sunday night, last night, before Biden and McCarthy connect again in Washington today. Going into those discussions, McCarthy and fellow GOP negotiator Garrett Graves, a Republican from Louisiana, underscored that the crux of the talks concerns the extent and duration of new restrictions on federal spending. Once that fundamental piece is in place, Representative Graves said, everything else cascades. Is that an oversimplification, do you think, John?
I don't think so. I think the encouraging thing from my vantage point, and of course, no one outside of the principals in the discussion really truly understand what's happening behind the closed door. But the good thing, as I see it, is that both sides, President Biden and Speaker McCarthy, have adults in the room representing them. Garrett Graves is a very serious lawmaker. He's also joined by Patrick McHenry, who happens to be chairman of the Financial Services Committee. both very serious, sober kind of people. The president has Shalonda Young, who is an experienced Hill staffer, who is now, the last year and a half, the OMB director, as well as Steve Ricchetti, who is a longtime Biden aide. So the principals have real serious people in the room, and that's good. And I think that, look, it's kind of where we were last week at this time on this program. The Democrats and the administration never figured that Speaker McCarthy could pass a debt ceiling bill in the House with a narrow majority, with the Freedom Caucus and folks that are really not conducive to a deal or a bargain or a compromise. But he did succeed in passing it, and that changed the whole dynamic of this discussion, because the president was laying out for many weeks. In fact, as the speaker said, he didn't meet with McCarthy for something like 101 days or something like that since early February. And because the Democrats played their hand, figuring McCarthy couldn't pass a debt ceiling bill. He did pass it. He has a bill to extend the debt ceiling. He has a bill. Their bill will restrain future federal spending, going back to those awful days of fiscal year 2022, which was last year, and the restrictions flow from what was spent last year. So it really, the president and the Democrats played a hand that we should have a clean debt ceiling. I mean, that really is not typical of these kind of discussions. There have been many examples with debt ceiling agreements in the past where you had compromise over spending. And in fact, when Speaker Pelosi was in the room with President Trump in 2019, she got what she wanted, which was increased spending. The Republicans now having a portion of control of the government, half of the House, half of the Congress, are insisting that we restrict future increases in spending. So that's where it is. We have principals in the room, serious people in the room, and I still remain hopeful that this will get resolved.
David, or David, try it again. David Soares, all right.
I hope that you are absolutely 100% correct. The message that we are sending to not only our country but also the world is that we are a fragile nation when we can't get it together to do something as serious as raising our debt ceiling. The current configuration of our government and the inability of people to come together and compromise. To me, is placing the greatest challenge on whether or not we see any success. The idea that we're only a week or so out and we haven't gotten in a room to hammer out these very important details suggests to me that if anything is going to happen, it is going to be in the 11th hour, but there will be damage. And the idea that what also doesn't sit well with me, and I don't know how it's going to sit with a lot of the Democrats, is how is it that we can, punish what I would consider to be the poor in limiting spending on programs for the poor in order to accommodate a party that won't compromise on the tax cuts that were passed several years ago by then former President Donald Trump.
Sure.
Yeah, I think I agree with David on the fact that this is going to hurt the poor, and it's going to create a larger group of poor people in America. And I keep going back to the stuff, focused on medical deserts in this country, because the cost of taking care of oneself and then needing, if you're a parent, also needing care for your children, with the cuts that are being proposed in this budget plan or package by the Republicans about work requirements, especially in places where there are no work, right? Work is very limited in certain places. Those things are going to, I think, increase poverty. And especially if you have children and if you're in a state where there's increasing abortion restrictions. And we've seen in those states, when it comes to women's health, you also have disappearing medical practices there to help them with maternity And with just general women's reproductive health issues. I don't see that part of the plan. I see that as being pretty devastating. And just this past weekend, a report came out from Tulane University, a paper showing that there's a $450 billion economic disparity when it comes to racial differences in cost for medical help in this country that has been created but will continue to be perpetuated. I think this plan is going to need, by the Republicans, is going to need some altering. And I guess my big question is can McCarthy keep his Freedom Caucus in when the negotiations are being made and some concessions and compromises are going to have to happen?
Well, the whole issue is that there has to be a compromise between the two sides.
Mm-hmm.
President Biden refused to negotiate, and because he figured, and maybe there was some validity to his figuring, that McCarthy couldn't pull that disparate group of people together mm-hmm. to pass something. Well, he did. Chuck Schumer hasn't passed anything because he can't pass it in the Senate. You need 60 mm-hmm. votes to pass it in the Senate. One of the things Republicans are going to insist on, and something that President Biden has voted for in the past, is to make sure we have reasonable work rules. Now, what are we talking about? We're talking about able-bodied adults without dependents at home, people who are capable of being in a training program or working. We now have a situation in the country, and frankly, employers all over the country can't find help. And in fact, whether it's, I've heard of it, DA's offices can't find people to staff DA's offices. We have over 10 million published job vacancies in the country, which is double the number of unemployed people. Now, take SNAP, which is mm-hmm. also Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, also used to be known as food stamps. New York is one of 13 mm-hmm. states that has manipulated the unemployment data so that the entire state of New York is exempt from work rules under SNAP. 13 states have done that. All, by the way, Democratic-led states.
How are we defining manipulated?
They have basically they use the unemployment data in a way that doesn't exempt just areas that which might have high unemployment, say over 6 or 7%, and there are actually very few counties in New York State that are at those levels, and they use it to seek a waiver, which New York State has done, and they've not sought to repeal it, a waiver so that the entire state is exempted from work requirements. 13 states have done this. The Agriculture Department has accepted these waivers, and I think it's extremely dubious. So many average people say, hey, look, I go to work every single day. Why should someone who is not working, who is receiving public assistance, who is able-bodied, who's under 60 years old, who has no dependents to take care of, why should they not be forced to work 20 hours a week or be in an employment and training program?
So do you think that that's going to be the issue, the largest issue that the Republican-led House is going to demand? Do you think that's the compromise?
The one thing that I think the areas of compromise are, as Garrett Graves said, what Joe quoted, is going to be the length of they put out a thing saying their bill said, we want to limit the spending increases in discretionary spending for 10 years. Well, that probably is not going to be 10 years as a compromise. Mm-hmm. It'll probably be 5 years or 3 years. They said we'll extend the debt ceiling until sometime, I think it was April of next year, April of 24. Well, that clearly, both the president is going to want that to go beyond the presidential election. That's an area of compromise. Mm-hmm. But I think also the issue of work requirements, and the question where the Democrats, I think, are probably going to be very hard for them to accept is a work requirement for eligibility for Medicaid. But, you know, just like President Clinton did with TANF, which is the welfare program, mm-hmm. we have existing work requirements for SNAP, which 13 states, including New York, have completely had themselves waived and exempted from. Look, every employer that I talk to in this area says they have jobs. They can't fill them because they can't find people. Now, I think that's really the crux of it. And in terms of getting people in the workforce, lifting people out of poverty, giving hope and opportunity to people. Work is the best social welfare program we can have. Get people in the workforce if they're able to work and they don't have dependents at home. I think this is one of those things where 70% of the people, including Democrats, generally agree with this.
So we have less than a minute, but go ahead. When you start, we can certainly finish up on the other side.
Just certain details where the areas of compromise exist. What I'm concerned about is the inability of the speaker to actually get the fringe, wing of his party on board, and whether or not we would have the minority leader, Hakeem Jeffries. Will he be able to bring and deliver those votes?
Yeah, if the president agrees to a deal with McCarthy, it's going to be a bipartisan plan. It'll be a bipartisan vote.
All right. We have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. John Faso, Jennifer Burns, David Soares. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back after this news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable on this Monday, the 22nd of May, 34 minutes past 9 o'clock. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org. David, I had to cut you off for the break. Anything else you wanted to say?
No, it's going to be very interesting to see, how many Democrats are going to be needed, who are in the minority right now, in order to get this thing passed. And especially now, when the word compromise does not seem to exist in our government.
There's another thing I've been thinking about, and I don't know enough about this. So everybody here may know more, or the listeners. Over the weekend, I heard some talk in multiple different TV shows about how what the Republicans are proposing would gut parts of the Inflation Reduction Act when it came to climate change and fossil fuels. And I was wondering exactly, I was trying to research to find out what they were advocating for that would reduce, either the employment or reduce the effect that Biden had initially wanted in the Inflation Reduction Act as it came to climate change and fossil fuels. Do either of you or anybody know more about that?
Well, the Republicans and some Democrats like Joe Manchin mm-hmm. want to expedite permitting for energy projects that include fossil fuel projects. That's something that Joe Manchin was promised when they passed the Inflation Reduction Act, but was never delivered upon. And he's causing all sorts of problems for the administration because of that on unrelated issues. But there's an aspect of the Inflation Reduction Act which I still think was misnamed, but the Inflation Reduction Act, as they passed it, where certain energy credits, tax credits, were projected by the CBO to cost a certain hundreds of millions of dollars, are actually costing 3 and 4 times that amount. So there's a desire to rein in some of those things. And so I think it's unlikely as a final compromise that mm-hmm. you're going to see. I don't think the Democrats will agree to some of those changes on curtailing some of mm-hmm. the energy tax credits that were for renewables. I do think that there will be an area of compromise will be the permitting reform for certain energy projects that Republicans and some Democrats want. Mm-hmm. So I think that's another area of compromise as I foresee it. It's very clear that, David, you're absolutely right talking about compromise and the polarized political environment we have. There are a lot of people in my party and there are a lot of people in the Democratic Party who view compromise as a dirty word. They want all or nothing. And I've always believed, as Ronald Reagan used to say, that if I can get half a loaf now and come back and try to fight for it later, better to get something rather than getting nothing. And a lot of things that are important for the American people aren't getting done because of this intransigence refusal to compromise. Now, we have a government structure right now where the House is controlled by Republicans, the Senate, Democrats, but you still need 60 mm-hmm. votes in the Senate to pass anything. presidency is obviously in the Democrats' hands. So that very nature means you must compromise in order to get things done. And, you know, one last thing I would say, there are many things that go on in Congress where there is routine compromise between and among the different factions and parties. A lot of things pass with well over 300 votes in the House, for instance, but you don't hear about those things because they're not controversial. And so that's another feature of the way in which many of us tend to, you know, listen to siloed media where you're only getting one point of view. There are a lot of things, you know, compromise doesn't necessarily generate clicks on media or advertising. And so there actually is more compromise that goes on, but you just don't hear about it.
We have, did you want to respond?
And it's also a shame because we wait for these opportunities, like lifting the ceiling here, to then legislate, right? We shouldn't be waiting for these moments to get things done. We should be getting things done all throughout. We shouldn't wait for an apocalyptic event to then begin leveraging all of the things that you should have been working on and compromising on and legislating throughout.
Well, a perfect example of what you just said, David, is the failure of Congress to pass appropriation bills on a timely basis. And that means at the end of year, as they were at the end of 2022, they pass a 4,000-page omnibus appropriations bill, which obviously virtually, you know, very few people have been able to actually fully examine. But that's what happens when they don't pass the 12 individual appropriation bills that should go through the normal routine in Congress.
We have a lot of letters on this, so let's get to those. Please remind, this from JD, please remind Mr. Faso who created 25% of the current debt and that the Republican debt ceiling bill is totally unacceptable to the majority of the country's population, but that yacht owners and private jet owners will certainly approve of it. We go to Robert. Deja vu is the tune played over and over with this issue every year. This continuing game of political chicken is going to kill thousands of innocent citizens someday. We must vote our way out of this mess. That from Robert. We go to Laura, who says, raising the debt ceiling being necessary to paying our country's debts, could someone please explain to me why the president can't just invoke the 14th Amendment and then raise the debt ceiling? We've talked a lot about this. But
there's a very good reason why he can't invoke the 14th Amendment. It would be unconstitutional for the president to violate the provisions on debt and spending. I mean, who will buy the bond that the government issues under the circumstance of invoking the 14th Amendment, when it's very clear to many of us and most constitutional scholars that that wouldn't be constitutional? Remember, the 14th Amendment was one of the Reconstruction Amendments. Mm-hmm. And think about it. The radical Republicans, as they were called, who were the radical abolitionists, you know, I guess being radical on that was a good thing. I sure think so. But the radical Republicans who controlled Congress, they were at war with Andrew Johnson.
Yes.
Who was president and who was in many respects a Confederate sympathizer. He was a Democrat from Tennessee. He was a border state. But the notion that they would have created the 14th Amendment, which says that all debts must be honored, et cetera, under provisions of law, the notion that they would have created the 14th Amendment to give Andrew Johnson unfettered ability to issue debt without the approval of Congress is just simply ludicrous. Right. I can tell you how you don't need to be an originalist, a follower or a devotee of Justice Scalia to come to that conclusion. So it would be a very big mistake for the president to do this. And ask, think about it. He would be issuing the saying that I can waive the debt ceiling in order to facilitate spending, not just paying debt. If it was just paying debt, in April, the government received $650 billion of tax revenue. It's a typical April 15th kind of month that they would get. They had about $60 billion of debt to pay. So someone will say, well, you had $600 billion of revenue. why couldn't you pay the $60 billion? Some say you should prioritize pay because you had the revenue to do it. In March, the government received, say, $350 billion in revenue, and it still had about $60 billion of debt to pay. So the notion that the 14th Amendment, which was crafted by the radical Republicans after the Civil War, during Reconstruction, and they meant to make sure that you couldn't, that if Southern politicians took control in Washington, that they couldn't forgive Confederate debt. That's why they did this. But the notion that the president can come in and just waive by the stroke of a pen, the forgiveness the removal of the debt limit to authorize more spending. Remember, spending is under control of the Congress. And so it would be fundamentally anti-democratic, small d, if the president were to do this, because it would usurp the constitutional role of Congress. It would, to my mind, be clearly unconstitutional. It wouldn't survive. And you talk about creating uncertainty as to the issuance of debt. If the president does this, it would certainly create legal and constitutional uncertainty.
I think it would set a dangerous precedent, too. Right, in who in the future is elected and what they could do in turning toward authoritarian kind of rule.
Right.
It would be.
I think even the conversation right now is, I think even the discussion would cause rippling effects in the market.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's go back to the letters. Brian says, I have a distant relative who's collecting public assistance. She is able-bodied, 30-plus years old, with no children at home. She is unwilling to work, even with family continually shaming her. I see no issue with a work requirement to force the issue in this case. I do believe, however, with this issue is a red herring trying to attract support for the Republican agenda, which likely includes far more devastating and hurtful cuts. The devil is in the details, and the potential impacts on the poor aren't really being talked about. That from Brian. We also go to Betsy. I heard John Faso claim that people are just not working when jobs are available, so work requirements will make them take these jobs and not need SNAP. I have news for you. I was working and on SNAP. I doubt Mr. Faso would know a SNAP recipient from anyone else. I think he has a stereotype about who we are. Then,
well, I think she may have a stereotype about me, but that's leave that
that's
aside.
A very good point. We go to Maureen. Your panelist, who is concerned about employers who can fill positions, is forgetting that we are barring immigrants from entering the country. These are the folks who do the jobs that are going without employees. Unless we address this issue, employers will continue to be shorthanded. Then Dave checks in and so said, no less a constitutional scholar than Warren's tribe has already said that the 14th Amendment is indeed constitutional. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have many more letters. We have many more topics. And we have lots of really brilliant thoughts in the heads of our panelists. They will dispense those at will right after this. With the headline debt ceiling negotiations back on, we have been discussing the issue this morning, and that has gotten us a lot of letters, and I'd like to get through as many of those as possible to the top of the hour break with anyone on the panel. Please invited to jump in if you have anything that you would like to add or comment on regarding the letter. Leonard says, why do you think those jobs are empty? Because they don't pay well enough to justify the level of work. Pay the people what they're worth rather than treating them as nothing more than a number on a ledger, says Leonard. Jeffrey, my foggy crystal ball cleared momentarily and indicated that powers that be will announce, quote, a lot of historic progress has been made, announce an extension bill, and state that a compromise bill is taking shape. Ultimately, the far right and far left members will howl when the compromise bill hits the floor to be voted on, and life goes on. Cynicism,
wow.
I believe. Yes.
Howl.
John Faso, this is from John, about John. All right.
It's a Dear John letter.
Did you just
letter.
Send it?
Yes, it's a Dear John letter.
It's a John to John.
John Fassonose's descriptions of the House bill is wildly incomplete. He knows that the only way Kevin McCarthy got 217 votes, including George Santos, was by telling moderate members, don't worry about what's in the bill. These draconian cuts are never going to happen. I wish four or five New York Republican moderates would act the way the MAGAs act and refuse to vote on any bill that doesn't include rolling back the Trump taxes for the rich. However, I won't hold my breath that Molinaro, Waller, and others do the right thing.
The tax bill actually has a lot of provisions that expire in 2025, and that's when these issues are going to be renewed in terms of the discussion.
Let's go to Peter. Tell that guy that the spending has already been approved by Congress. It's the cap that's holding it up. One of the two of you.
Tell that guy.
Yeah, that guy.
All right.
No, that guy. All right. We go to Consider Them Told. Jerry says if employers up their pay, they will find workers. It is called the market. Then we go to Nancy. Our current debt has already been approved by the Congress. The Congress is now refusing to pay that debt. That is where the president has a right to invoke the Constitution to force the Congress to pay the debt. It really is not rocket science.
No, the Constitution actually is not rocket science. It's written there in black and white, and it would be very, very constitutionally suspect if the president were to take this step. He's done some things before that have been constitutionally suspect, like the student loan plan, which I believe the Supreme Court will make work of very shortly. But eviction moratorium was another where the president said that he basically and his advisors advised him that this was likely unconstitutional to extend that, but he went ahead and did it anyway, saying, well, maybe I'll get another month or two out of it before the court struck it down. So, I mean, I think that one of the concerns I have about our whole system, and this was back in the Trump presidency, I was very much against the way he used the tariff power in a way, for instance, against our Canadian neighbors to the north on a national security basis, which was ludicrous because the Canadians pose no military threat to the United States. Indeed, they're our closest allies. So the tendency of the executive, whether they're Democrat or Republican, to assert authority that they is not given them in the Constitution, whether it's in trade or whether it's in, say, the Biden student loan proposal, is very dangerous to our democratic system. And people will say, well, Congress isn't working; they're not getting the job done. Well, that still isn't an excuse to violate the Constitution. I'd point back in the late part of the 19th century, the last 25 years. Congress, the control of Congress shifted about four or five times based upon the free coinage of silver issue. And of course, that issue went away and no one remembers it now. But that's where people can assert their democratic right to send representatives to Washington to do what they want or to not do what they don't want. So that's where we should be focused on trying to make sure that Congress does its job, but also make sure the president doesn't overstep, because otherwise what separates us from those totalitarian systems mm-hmm. where they just run roughshod over the courts and over the people's elected representatives?
Mm-hmm. I think what we've seen in the last, I would say, 10 years has been legislative encroachment on the executive authority. We've seen the executive also overstep executive authority. And I think in both instances, we have people that want to get caught trying, right? We see these very favorable political issues, whether it's the moratorium on housing or student loans. And I think they even take that step knowing that they're going, as you said, buying 3 months, buying 4 months. But they want to be caught trying.
Mm-hmm. Back to the mailbag. We go to Will, who says, okay, John, so we should not raise taxes on the extremely well-off, but instead torment the lowest-income people in our society. The debt ceiling should not be held hostage by quote-unquote terrorists because they want a win, nor to make the president look bad. Only Republicans do this. You should be ashamed of your allegiance to that political party. Yeah, John.
What'd you do? What'd you do, man?
Someone got up on the wrong side of the bed today. You know, I think that this is a very serious issue, though, the issue of the debt ceiling. And it is, as David said, it does send a bad message as to the ability of the United States to solve problems. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you could look at it as, well, the people around the world see we have these messy, divisive fights, and we kind of hash it out, and ultimately we come, as Winston Churchill once said, Americans always, consider all the alternatives until they finally come to the right one. Mm-hmm. And the fact is that, you know, we're showing our system to be one where there's disagreement. It can be aired. It's not suppressed. And That's a good thing, but I hope compromise wins out on this thing, and I believe it will.
James says there are work requirements if you collect general public assistance and SNAP benefits. There are exceptions for raising children, the handicapped, and the elderly. I am on SNAP, and they do ask about where you work, how often, and how much you make. I currently work at Walmart and don't make enough to get by because my job doesn't pay enough for me to live in my current area without these benefits. There is a minimum number of hours of mandatory work to qualify to continue to receive these benefits. Walmart needs to raise wages, or I need SNAP to survive here. That from James. We then go to John. Both sides do it, full stop. Does that mean both sides do it in equal measure, equal intensity, and equal extremity? If no, then both sides do not do it, shouty caps. Every time that dubious phrase is uttered, it should be challenged immediately, shouty caps. Accountability might be on life support, but the concept is not dead. That from John. Then we go to this letter on the 14th Amendment from David. Thank you, Mr. Faso, for your explanation of the 14th Amendment. Given the language of that amendment, as written, can we guarantee that no configuration of the Supreme Court could interpret it otherwise?
I think so. In fact, what was heartening about the U.S. Supreme Court in recent weeks is the number of 9-0 decisions that they they issued. So, again, that didn't get a lot of coverage in the media. I think it's pretty clear that if the president were to act contrary, say he had the power to issue more debt and fund more appropriations without the authority of Congress, I think it would be struck down.
Frank writes, David's point about lack of compromise is understood. However, can Mr. Faso explain why the debt limit was raised automatically without problem during the Trump presidency?
It wasn't, actually. And when it was done in 2019, the president, in fact, Senator McConnell pointed this out the other day, the president didn't want to have to negotiate with Nancy Pelosi, mm-hmm. but he did because he had to. Mm-hmm. And what did Speaker Pelosi want? She wanted about $300 to $400 billion of additional discretionary spending, and she got it as a condition for raising the debt ceiling.
Tim writes, putting people to work as a requirement to receiving Medicaid is one thing, and another would be to stand up a national child care plan. To help support those who want to enter the employed ranks. Then we go to Dave, who says, no less a constitutional scholar. I read that one. I apologize for the repeat. Let's be clear. Permitting reform, says David, by the Republicans is targeting fossil fuels. So to pay already incurred bills, we need to exacerbate an existential threat. How is this a good compromise for our children? Writes David. Then Matt says, there is no compromise. David says there is no compromise in politics where the debt ceiling is concerned, as if the Dems just need to cooperate with the hostage takers. But this whole situation wouldn't be a situation if the Republican followed normal debt ceiling protocol and compromised by separating the two issues of debt ceiling increase versus future spending policy. Compromise is not the Dems just allowing the Republicans to take what they want by force.
I think we've seen both parties take advantage of this specific issue to leverage to get what they've wanted. And this has been done historically. So, you know, you can't now, when the Republicans have control of the House, take aim at them and the issues that they support, like energy, like clean energy, not clean energy, but fossil fuel legislation.
Kevin says, where is the agency or clearinghouse to connect the unemployed seeking assistance with the jobs? Then Andrew says, what's the point of work requirements if unemployment is down around 3%? Who's left to work? Immigrants. Sounds more like a lack of immigration problem to me. Then we go three quick letters, and then we'll go to news. Irene says, I'm listening closely to what Mr. Faso is saying about SNAP. I don't really understand his explanation as to why able-bodied people under 60 aren't required to look for work. His explanation is missing nuance, meaning the details that are important when making statements like that. I can't believe him. His talking points are typical of Republicans that don't really understand why people stay on public assistance. Then we go to Jen. Listening to the discussion of getting people back to work with John Faso, there is a strong discrimination against single people with no kids that needs to be discussed. I'm single. I have to pay 100% of my mortgage myself. I pay more in taxes than a married couple. I pay more in taxes than people with kids. Utilities, food, and gas are not less because only one person is using them. Having kids doesn't make you a hero in an overpopulated world. Having kids should never be a discrimination point when people who are single bear the costs of schools and education with using those systems. My daily costs far exceed my friends with children. I don't disagree with his view, but his qualifiers aren't right by any means. We'll take a break there and we'll move on. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be back with much more content right after Ray Graff and News. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Monday morning. It is the 22nd of May, 8 minutes past 10 o'clock. John Faso, Jennifer Burns, and David Soares with us on this broadcast. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Let us move on to other topics. I think we're all debt ceilinged out for today. But don't worry, we'll talk about it more, I'm pretty sure. Let's go to the G7. President Biden announcing more aid for Ukraine as the group of seven powers meet in Japan. The President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine received vows of resolute support and promises of further weapon shipment, even as Russian forces claim to have received the war-torn city of Bakhmut. The President Biden and other leaders of the world's industrial democracies rallied around Ukraine on Sunday with vows of support and promises of further weapons. Mr. Biden and his counterparts figuratively and in some cases literally wrapped their arms around the president of Ukraine, who made an audacious journey halfway around the world from his ravaged homeland to Hiroshima, Japan, to solicit aid for the first time in person from the group of seven at their annual summit. Together with the entire G7, we have Ukraine's back, and I promise we're not going anywhere, Mr. Biden told Mr. Zelensky while announcing another $375 million in artillery, ammunition, and other arms for Ukraine. At a later news conference, Mr. Biden voiced defiance of President Vladimir Putin of Russia. I once more shared and assured President Zelensky, together with all G7 members and our allies and partners around the world, that we will not waver. Putin will not break our resolve as he thought he could. David?
Well, I think we need to continue to send that message and send it as loudly and as globally as we can. And I cannot think of a greater stage than for our president to have sent that message. You know, we're getting the almost daily reports of what's happening right now in this conflict. And I do understand that in terms of, you know, President Putin, what he wants is to prolong this war. And the more that he can prolong it, the better it is for him. And I think his gamble and his hope is that he will exhaust the American and global resolve towards helping, you know, our Ukrainian friends. And I just think that that was a very important message to have sent to President Zelensky. And I think that, you know, right now we have to continue to support his efforts and support the defense of Ukraine. And we need to provide him with as many tools as he can in order to effectively defend his borders.
Jennifer?
I guess what I'm struggling with here is how sometimes we fail to see that the G7 and the United States in particular is really controlling so much of the direction of this war. Right? It's fine steps to not really, excite Putin in a way where he does something that everybody claims will be catastrophic. But at the same time, I know we can't just deliver all kinds of things immediately, but our staggered approach has an economic kind of coercion feel to it to me. And I think part of what's going on is the United States' real focus on China and how China's going to move. So I think it's important that we're supporting Ukraine, but I don't think we're paying enough attention to how we're kind of going back and forth and really negotiating in a way that's kind of extending the suffering in Ukraine.
John?
Well, I'm glad that the president said that he would have Ukrainian pilots be trained in the F-16. Candidly, I wish that was something that he did many, many months ago. Mm-hmm. I also hope that the long-awaited Abrams tanks are delivered quicker than had previously been considered. And the other issue that we have, and this is why it's important that we maintain, because of China, because mm-hmm. of these challenges with Iran and Russia, it's we have to maintain our defense forces in a way that makes our deterrence credible. The best way we deter armed conflict with China or and the United States is to maintain a very strong, credible defense capability. And that burden is not going to be borne by any other nation than the United States. The Europeans finally, the Germans recently are stepping up. They've been very laggard, even despite some of their announcements last year. And I think you're seeing with Finland and Sweden, hopefully the Swedes get into NATO with Turkish objections going away. But when you see the Finns and the Swedes joining NATO, you know that finally the Europeans have awakened to the threat that Putin threatened, mm-hmm. That he is. And the energy extortion that he's attempted over Western Europe is something that should be a wake-up call for Americans in terms of how we address our energy policies. But I'm pleased that the president continues to enunciate strong support for Ukraine. It has to go beyond the rhetoric, and I think we're showing that we're prepared to continue to help them in this fight.
I happen to believe that the staggered approach has been very appropriate. And I know that there have been critics that have wanted, basically to give the Ukrainians everything all at once instead of what they're doing mm-hmm. now. But I think that America, and especially with NATO, has had to play this very cautious, they've had to manage the escalation of this war. And the escalation on a variety of different fronts, not wanting Ukraine to launch, missiles you know, into the capital of Russia, not wanting them to be, you know, provocative to the extent, and I say that in air quotes, to the extent that you're defending yourself from that kind of aggression. But I think that America has been, and our European and NATO partners have been very good at managing this battle and this effort, and have had to take these kind of steps in order to make sure that we don't have escalation.
But one of the risks that we have was in our own defense infrastructure. The ability to produce the artillery munitions, the ability to produce the HIMARS, long-range artillery systems. We have a limited capacity. And the one thing that this Ukrainian war of aggression by Russia has awakened in Americans, I think, and certainly in among members of Congress on both sides, is the fact that we just can't put our foot on the accelerator and deliver the kind of weaponry that we need because we don't have the capacity to build it. And that's really concerning, especially when you consider the multifaceted threats that we are facing around the world right now, especially China, Iran, Russia. It's truly a dangerous situation that we're in.
Well, and last night I was watching 60 Minutes. And the first segment was on the investigation that was led by the DOJ on the increase that the government was being charged for producing these military weapons, right? So that there was a consolidation of many companies in America down to about five or six. And then they raised the costs on missiles and all of these other things. So the U.S. was spending billions of dollars more on the same items. So they kind of price gouged the government, the military on this. And now you look at how we're dealing with our debt spending, we're looking at our budgeting, we're looking at our military expenditures. And some of those things are coming down to how do we get in check these companies that are charging us a lot of money to have this kind of equipment that then we would like to use or send to the Ukraine. So overall, it's increasing our military spending on both ends.
And this is a longstanding problem. Harry Truman made his reputation in the U.S. mm-hmm. Senate before he was nominated for vice president in 1944. Harry Truman made his reputation by exposing profiteering by companies taking advantage. And this, you can go back to the Revolutionary War and find instances mm-hmm. of this. So yes, we absolutely have to be vigilant purchasers of mm-hmm. this kind of equipment. We also have to recognize that the inflation factor that has occurred in the last year and a half of general prices in our yeah. economy is affecting this sector as well. So whether it's acquisition of raw materials, it is, or the component parts, and making sure we're not importing those mm-hmm. from unfriendly countries
right.
as well, it is going to be, it continues to be a real issue.
There's so many things that I think has exposed our economy. I think, these supply chains have exposed the limitations within our own economy. And if that can trigger a bipartisan, discussions about, repatriation or expanding our manufacturing base, there's just so many areas within our own country that is in desperate need of that kind of economic impact.
You're right.
When you look at what happened in the G7, so where do you think we go from here in the next time, meaningful talks take place and where all of these sides get together and discuss what the plan is?
The one thing that I'm very, very curious about is Finland and their contributions to this
thing so often said.
Yeah.
That is a nation that has one of the premier military forces in the world, and their technology, the amount of weapons that they have stockpiled. I mean, they have been preparing for their defense against an aggressive Russia right. for the better part of the last six, seven decades. And so it'll be interesting to see whether or not their contributions will lessen, you know, some of the contributions that we unfortunately have been taking on all by ourselves.
All right, let's move on to other topics, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. So let us talk about Uvalde. It is Wednesday. We'll mark the one-year anniversary of the shooting at Uvalde in Texas, and some officials and residents are in conflict with victim supporters over information as well as legislation as this one-year anniversary approaches this week. A year ago, a gunman marched into Uvalde's Robb Elementary School, shut himself in a classroom, and massacred 19 fourth graders and two teachers, while hundreds of police officers stood outside. Those connected to the victims and their advocates have spent the past year battling for information and battling for legislation. Some of their neighbors, however, want the noise to stop. Even in an era of frequent mass shootings, the Robb Elementary attack shocked the world. Law enforcement waited to intervene for more than an hour, even as children within the classroom called 911, begging for help when a Border Patrol tactical team finally entered and took down the killer. They saw he had written LOL on a whiteboard with the victim's blood. Now, with the one-year mark approaching, the South Texas town of 15,400 is divided over how to move forward. Many families of those killed and their advocates continue to be vocal in their efforts to get information, while officials say that information, that investigation of the incident has to take priority over releasing information. Advocacy for new gun legislation has also led to conflict. This from the Wall Street Journal. John?
Well, it's hard to say any more than what you just said. I mean, this was just a horrific tragedy. And what
music to a talk show host's ears.
Well, you've actually been rather reticent today, I think. You're not your normal perky innovative self in terms of
he hasn't taken any bullets for you.
He hasn't. But
perky and innovative. I'll work on that.
Yeah. It's what I find truly mystifying in this was that 1 hour delay of those law enforcement to go in, and I still have not heard a good explanation. I don't think there is one, frankly, of what happened, how that command structure broke down, and what they've done to make sure that doesn't occur again. There have been the shooting in Nashville that happened a number of months ago. Those law enforcement officers intervened right away, and they prevented what would have been a greater tragedy. So, but I still think that officials down there need to be more forthcoming with this information as to what actually was going on there with law enforcement.
The tone was set by that chief, as well as the support that chief received from the local political body in Uvalde. So,
but think of how long it took to get rid of that chief.
Correct, because there was a lot of information that was withheld early on. Right, there was a lot of misrepresentation of facts that took place early on, and that chief seemed to be enjoying the protection and cover. If you recall, that chief was about to become part of that body. Mm-hmm. And so I think that you have, in the infancy stages of this tragedy, you had distrust. And that distrust has just continued to grow as time has gone on. And here we are one year later. It's hard for me to imagine that whether it's the federal body, the state agencies within that jurisdiction haven't been able to come up with a lot of information that they can share. I certainly understand them not having, you know, everything complete. I think what took place there was incredible, and I don't think that you can go back and recreate a lot of those those issues without having time. But I do think that there's enough that's taken place within one calendar year that they can, in fact, share some information with the public. But I think that what we're seeing right now in Uvalde, in terms of the tensions that are there, they've always been there. It's just grown.
Jennifer?
You know, this stinks like a cover-up. It is very clear, and we saw this from the beginning, right, that the law enforcement and the strategy that they had in Uvalde was chaotic. I mean, it doesn't appear in everything that I've read and watched that they actually had a plan to try to address this kind of issue if it happened. And we saw that with who couldn't figure out whom was in charge of taking the direction to actually lock down the school after the shooter was in it, right? Everybody thought it was somebody else who was in charge to take order from. And so, yes, I think investigations take a long time, but I think part of the issue here may also be that people are trying to cover up a little bit of what they didn't do correctly, and also to clean this up so it doesn't look like the chaos within the system itself that was definitely present when the shooting started.
It's impossible for me to believe that this department did not have a SWAT-trained team. You have departments all over the country that train for very specific issues, this being one of them. Prior to Uvalde, there were plenty of examples out there in the world of mass shooters in different scenarios in public spaces. And every police department trains in taking down an active shooter. And if the department isn't large enough for them to have a SWAT team on their own, they're usually part of a task force that takes surrounding departments that create that team. What I think happened here is a combination of incompetence and cowardice.
Yeah, and what is on paper sounds good and looks good, but in reality, if it works, is a whole different story, right? And I think that's some of what we're seeing in Uvalde, is that there might have been pieces on paper all over that had different departments and SWATs and tasks and all of these things, but the reality of who gets there, when, who's in charge, right? Some of the positions, the leaders were changing, right? Because they were there was an election or something, right? So some people had were leaving office, other people are coming in at different places, yeah, too, which complicates it, right? Are they still working on something or have already checked out?
The chief was still there. The chief was still there, and this has been the chief that would have overseen a SWAT team. He would have had decisions as to who participates in a SWAT team. There's no executive in law enforcement that doesn't engage in collaboration with neighboring departments that are not part of agencies or not part of task forces that are taking on, you know, threats that not only impact their community but neighboring communities as well.
It's hard. I mean, we've heard we've seen the video of what was going on. We've heard the shots be fired. We've heard. I mean, just the time frame is so troubling of how long it took, and I don't why parents can't get even some answers seems to be just insane.
Yeah.
Because I understand all the legal ramifications of that, but by the same token, their children were killed.
It's even worse when you consider we have our neighbors here in the Capital District. We have our FBI. We have federal agencies. We have state agencies. We have local agencies, and there's a great collaborative spirit. So even if we had to trace every single bullet, and how that bullet traveled, there's enough agencies that have the technology, the expertise that also could be involved in finding and delivering these answers. And the idea that we're here 1 year out and we still have nothing is just so troubling. And as you say, it reeks of cover-up.
Yes. And I note when the Pulitzer Prize were announced that Shimon Prokopez from CNN was a Pulitzer Prize winner. And I think looking at some of the reporting that he has done on this issue is rather enlightening. And I know he just had an anniversary special. There's some really good questions that are asked within the context of that. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We will continue right after this short break in BBC News. As the words were cascading from my lips, I knew I was not saying the right thing. So I was talking about Shimon Prokopets, and I said Pulitzer Prize. It's the two other P awards, the Polk Award and the Peabody Award. Mm. So my apologies. I knew as I was saying it, I was making a mistake. The Polk and the Peabody, just for the sake of correcting myself. All right, let's go on and find out what else is making news. And we welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And we would, as always, love to hear from you. Let's go to the Tim Scott campaign. What Tim Scott's 2024 campaign could mean for Black Republicans. This from the New York Times. Senator Tim Scott, a Republican of South Carolina, addressed the Charleston County Republican Committee at a dinner in February, offering a stirring message of unity and American redemption that has become the center of his stump speech. The next day, he called the chairman of the county party to ask for support. Mr. Scott told the chairman that he was considering a presidential run. The chairman, who had planned to endorse former President Donald Trump, told the senator he would switch allegiances and back him instead. The exchange was in some ways traditional party politicking, as Mr. Scott works to build support in his home county and in his home state. But it also underscored a subtle change shaping GOP politics. Both men are Black Republicans. I'm pretty locked in helping Senator Scott in every way that I possibly can, said the former county party leader Maurice Washington, who stepped down from his role as chairman in April. It was Mr. Washington, Charleston County's first Black Republican chairman and longtime ally of Mr. Scott's, who first encouraged him to run for a county council seat nearly 30 years ago. Mr. Scott, who plans to formally announce his presidential campaign today, will become one of a handful of Black conservatives to run for president in recent years, adding to the list of Herman Cain and Ben Carson.
Come on.
Oh, David, go first, please.
Herman Cain. Well, this is going to be a very interesting campaign. Personally, I really, really, really like Mr. Scott's story. Son of descendants of slaves, and a person who credits his family, the culture in which he was raised, with his success. He's very quick to always remind people of his background. He's got a very wonderful story about being an African American in the Carolinas, growing up in that culture. I think that he's going to be one of those candidates that people tend to underestimate. But I think with like Barack Obama's campaign, when he first made his announcement, I think people underestimated him. This is a campaign that can be he can be that candidate that I think runs a civil and raises important issues, as opposed to slinging mud, which I think a lot of the other candidates are going to be engaged in. So it'll be interesting to see. But I think he will add a sober voice to the primary for the Republican nomination.
Jennifer.
Well, it's very nice. I'm complimenting you on that because
I'm not suggesting to you that I agree with his policies, but certainly I think.
Yes, his story is nice, but I also find it a little bit denialism of the racism that does take place across America, especially saying it in a day and age when we're watching increased violence happen to Black men, particularly in America, of different classes, largely across the country. And he sort of acts like that's not really happening, like you're, don't believe your lying eyes. And then he will sometimes use that race as a dog whistle to say, well, I've experienced a few encounters of racism. And so see, everything can just be, you know, it's individualistic, let it go away. And I find that quite hypocritical on his part. And I find it a little bit power hungry. And I think he, while having a nice story and having what appears to be good values, also cannot get enough likes, as the young people say, from his colleagues either. The one major initiative that I was hoping that he would be able to work with Democrats on was police reform. And that did not happen. And nobody said it was to blame him or to blame Hakeem Jeffries or others, but the fact that he has largely, in all of my research, walked away from the issue is a problem. And I think Democrats should really bring that up in addition to his clarifying abortion in the future.
John.
Well, Senator Scott is highly regarded within the Republican Party. He's got good friends on both sides of the aisle in D.C. He works well with colleagues. He's well-liked. And he's starting in Iowa with $8 million worth of advertising. Mm-hmm. He comes into the campaign with a $22 million war chest, which he's built up. There'll be an outside super PAC supporting his candidacy as well. I like he's got an optimistic message, a vision for the country. And I think that as a black Republican, he is going to attract new voters. And the question is, you know, there'll be other candidates that come forth this week. Ron DeSantis is going to announce this week. I'm told that Chris Christie is announcing. Mm-hmm. The governor of North Dakota, Governor Borgum, is going to announce. So the field is growing. Some are concerned that that will put the GOP back in the same position that it was in 16. With a multiple candidate field, and Donald Trump was able to, you know, get 30%
very large
consistently.
Stage.
Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm.
How do you feel about that?
Well, I think that it's good that we have multiple candidates. I'm hopeful that if a candidate doesn't receive appreciable support by a certain period of time in the race, that they'll see the writing on the wall and drop out. Because I don't think it would be the best solution for the country, most importantly, and the Republican Party, if Donald Trump is the nominee in 2024.
Is that polling or votes when you say support?
Could be like Kamala Harris, who withdrew from the campaign in 2020 before the first vote was cast.
Well, that's what I'm asking.
So
yeah.
It's going to be both. It's going to be money raised. It's going to be polling. It's going to be having a message that resonates. I think the message needs to be one talking about the future, not arguing about the past necessarily. Not that you forget the past, but that you be future oriented, because that's what most voters want to mm-hmm. hear. And I think that the big issue on the presidential race is that 70% of Americans don't want Joe Biden to be running, and 60% of Americans don't want Donald Trump to mm-hmm. be running. So you have a fairly strong majority of the population that does not want to see a Biden-Trump race in 24. And I hope that the political process brings us to that point mm-hmm. where we have alternatives.
John, do you think the National Party can get the candidates to agree to that metric, as you say?
No, I think
last time it was, I think it was the amount of money raised, it was the polling, right? That
got you on the stage.
Yeah.
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 And I think the reality is that if a candidate is not getting the kind of support they need, financial and political, they have no room. They have no place to go other than get out of the race. Well, but it's early now. It's only May. Of the year before the election. So I do think that there's time for these candidates. Governor Sununu of New Hampshire may be getting in as well.
Right.
So there's time for them to go out there and show their stuff. And that's what this summer is intended to do. And we'll see where it takes us. But I'm encouraged by Tim Scott getting in. It's kind of presents an interesting dynamic in with Nikki Haley, mm-hmm. who appointed him to the mm-hmm. Senate in South Carolina. They kind of have the same much of the same political base within South Carolina. But this is going to be it's a beauty contest to go out there and show the folks in Iowa and other states across the country what their stuff is and where they're coming from and how they differ from the past nominee of the Republican Party. And that's really what I think it's going to come down to.
I keep wondering, is the Republican Party ready, though, nationwide? Are they ready to elect the second black president of the United States have it be Tim Scott? Is the wider Republican Party ready
question,
for that?
Same question was asked about Barack Obama in 2007. You know, is the country ready? And you know what? Refreshingly, this country elected the first African-American president. Not that I agreed with 90% of what his positions were, but I thought that was a hopeful sign about...
So there was 10% that you agreed with?
I think there were. We didn't do a scientific survey on that. I think that was a hopeful sign. And, you know, people that lament the state of the racial relations in the country, I think this is a remarkably different country than the one that I was growing up in the 60s. I was born in the 50s, I hate to say. But it's a remarkably different country in terms of our acceptance of different people, different groups, et cetera. And the one metric that I really look at is what's the percentage of interracial marriages in our country today. It's about 20% when, you know, 30, 40 years ago, it was under 5%. And I think that's a sign of greater racial tolerance and acceptance in our country that is broader than a lot of the stuff that, you know, might be out there in some of the more incendiary folks in the media.
Well, that makes me wonder, you know, and I agree with you 100% on that. It brings into account the youth vote. Right. Especially if we're talking about abortion, the youth vote will be really front and center in how they're viewing black, white or, you know, everyone in America when it comes to the youth. Tim Scott's campaign, if he were to be nominated. But then also it draws into the conversation because of the interracial marriage bit, Clarence Thomas. And if people are looking beyond just who's elected president, but to how this is going to relate to the Supreme Court and others. And Clarence Thomas being that really one of probably the most, I would say, powerful black Republican in the country, right? It makes you wonder if some people will say that might be too much to elect Tim Scott as president with Clarence Thomas in the Supreme Court.
No, I don't think so. Jennifer,
I've already had some people talk about it to me.
I don't think about it. I think though, I just don't see the relationship on that score. But you know, Tim Scott or Nikki Haley. One of the important things about being out there and running mm-hmm. is that typically, people that run for president who don't make it might wind up being nominated for vice president.
That's true.
And Tim Scott would be a very appealing candidate, I think, for either position. And, you know, he's got a story to tell, and he delivers it in an affirmative way, an optimistic way. And I think, you know, that as someone who really admired the way in which Ronald Reagan presented himself to the country, he always spoke optimistically about the shining city on the hill and about a better America. And that's really what I think successful candidates do most frequently.
And I think that what I'm waiting to see is whether or not the Donald Trump venom has been cleared from the body politic of the Republican Party. Because that's a very contrasting candidates there, the Donald Trump wing of the party, and as well as the moderate wing of the party, has that venom been flushed from the Republican body?
That's what a campaign is for,
yeah. mm-hmm.
and we will find out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Let it be known that a campaign is for flushing.
We've been howling.
It would be interesting to see, like, a Nikki Haley, right, with Tim Scott or vice versa.
Yes. Well, they're from the same state. That would violate the Constitution.
Oh, it would?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know
President
that.
And vice presidential nomination can't be from the same state.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, that's good to know.
Tricky.
Somebody might move quickly. Well, we've seen it before.
In 2000, Dick Cheney was a resident of Texas, and he hurriedly scurried back to Wyoming in order to reestablish his residency in Texas for that very reason.
All right.
So you can see somebody relocate. Pay attention, right? It might be a hint.
So you can't infringe upon the debt in the 14th Amendment, and you can't have a VP and a presidential candidate from the same state. So that's our Constitution lesson today.
Takeaways today. Those are your takeaways.
That's right. I want to thank all of you for being with us. John Faso, Jennifer Burns, David Soares, a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us. We'll continue right after this break.